Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of August. Language is ingrown, disheveled, intricate, oral, mixed. Pure languages don't exist. It's likely as many humans speak more than one language as do not, and in the same mouth. Languages are no more likely to stay separate than two liquids. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book, What Language Is and What It Isn't and What It Could Be. John McWhorter is with us. He's a linguist, author of more than a dozen books, including Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue and Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America. He teaches linguistics and Western Civilization at Columbia University and is a contributing editor at The New Republic. It's a fascinating book because he looks at the history of languages and how the intricacy and complexity of language is directly related to the history of a place. Why is it that young people, children, can learn any language fast and perfectly when it's so hard for most adults to be able to do that? What are the most complicated languages on earth? What languages are disappearing? Will the world be a better place because they're gone and there won't be as many languages? Or are we losing something valuable because we are losing languages? He looks at Navajo, and as you know, they were the people who did the code in World War II, and how unapproachable it is to a newcomer, the language of the Navajo. So you're going to learn all kinds of things this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for John. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, John. Thank you very much for being with us. So you tell this story early on in the book, little did he know who was answering the door at your house, of an elderly man who'd been out walking, and he happened to be Persian, and you two just sat down and had quite a talk, even though you didn't speak Persian.
And I was much younger, and I didn't know anything about Persian. And what was interesting was that because the only thing that we had to talk about was language, I figured he could just teach me
a little bit about how you conjugate the verbs. So he wrote it down, and it was very easy. It was almost strangely easy, given what would happen if you asked, say, a Mexican person how to conjugate verbs in Spanish. You've got the whole different ways of doing the ARs and the ERs and the IR verbs. And with Persian, there was really almost none of that. And I found it interesting because that's not what you expect when you look at languages other than English. Actually, typical languages are much more complicated than we as English speakers can imagine anyone speaking without having several strokes a day just putting sentences together. So the Persian adventure was interesting because it set me on a whole exploration as to why Persian is so relatively easy. And I realized that there are patterns around the world and that languages that are that easy are the exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I never really thought of this at all, actually, but how languages change, obviously, because of history. People will conquer certain places. People don't speak just one language. They might be a bricklayer in one country, and then they move to another country, so they still speak their language of origin, but they have to speak another language. And everything kind of mixes, right?
They do mix. And if this happened in antiquity, before there was really anything called school and before there was widespread literacy or printing, if a whole lot of people moved from one place to another place and say they were bricklayers and they had to learn the new language, if they were adults, they learned it about as well as we tended to learn French or Spanish when we were taking it in school. And that could affect the entire language. And so what I'm speaking right now is a much more streamlined language than Anglo-Saxon Old English was. And that's because Vikings came to England. And you can look around the world and see that the languages that are as user-friendly as English, where you just have I walk, you walk, he walks, we walk, you all walk, they walk. That's very odd. The languages like that are the ones where you have something like these marauding Vikings in the history who, in a way, came in and messed the language up. That's not the way the vast majority of the world's languages are.
Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of time talking about the difference, and it makes a much larger point, why it is that Pashto, and explain what that is much more complicated than Persian, even though we're in the same part of the world here. Why such a difference?
Yeah, Pashto and Persian, which I don't think are in the same box in most of our heads, are related languages. They're both Iranian languages. And so roughly, Persian and Pashto are like English and German. And they're different in the same way as English and German in that Pashto, while it's related to Persian, is much more complicated. And so if, for example, you were sent to where Pashto is spoken nowadays and for, you know, reasons of the military or something like that, you would find, and I've spoken to people who have found, that Pashto is one of those languages where you'd really better have your thinking cap on and probably be kind of a language nerd to really get very far in it, as opposed to Persian, where you've got a lot of the same basic words, and you know, the grammars are clearly akin, but you've got a lot less of it. Pashto is a language that hasn't been learned a whole lot by adults over time. In other words, it's been normal. Pashto people are relatively inward-looking. It's a tight-knit community. Persian was the language of an empire, and so for a long time, people from all over Asia and even as far as what we now think of as Europe were coming to Persia. They were learning Old Persian, which was a hideously complicated language, and they made it more user-friendly. They broke it down the way we break up Spanish in a classroom. And that, streamlined and regularized, is the beautiful Persian language now. Pashto stayed normal. And so it is much more complex. Persian is the odd one. Pashto is the normal one.
We know how difficult it is, most of us, to try and learn a language when we're a bit older. You emphasize in several parts of the book, and I'm wondering why this is so, that children can learn any language lickety-split, right off the bat. 2 years old, they're speaking what their native tongue is, and they're speaking another language. But yeah. But with adults, it's just almost impossible, even for a very complicated language. Why is that?
It's a funny thing. We are genetically specified in some way to learn language. There are no mentally normal people who don't do it. It's not a matter of talent. Some people are more linguistically gifted than others, but everybody can do the basics. And that genetic specification is one of the many that we have that's programmed to kick in and be effective early. In the same way, teaching a human being to walk who's never done it until they are 30 years old is extremely difficult and for many people impossible, and not just because of muscles, but because your ability to come up with that neurological coordination is something that maturationally, as the experts put it, is something that you're programmed to be able to do early. And so if you're an adult, you can learn another language. Learning it perfectly is very difficult. Learning it and not speaking it without an accent is almost impossible. You can even see intermediate cases. Somebody who, for example, came to America at 15 or 16 often speaks the language perfectly. He's got all the idioms. You don't have to slow down. But they've got a tiny bit of an accent. And that's something that they're always going to have because their ability was beginning to ossify when they learned English. So that's just the way it is. And that difference has made it so that there are many different kinds of languages in the world depending on how old people are when they learn them.
And are you hearing it? I'm thinking about the grammar. Some of these languages, and you outline them in the book, are extremely complicated to remember what the grammar is, how the nouns take case, how the verbs conjugate. And it makes it a real tedious, laborious process to learn this. How are children just hearing this and it just sort of gets hardwired into the brain? They don't sit down and formally learn what the grammatical rules are, do they?
No. Their brains are extraordinarily plastic. The infant's brain is programmed to look for regularities, of course, and of course not actively, but subconsciously. And as a result, they seem to be searching for the rules, even though these are rules that they're not going to be able to spell out. And then there's just an incredible plasticity, which means that children can learn the exceptions. And so we think about think. We know very deeply that the past tense of think is not thinked. It's thought. Nobody told us that. We didn't have flashcards. It's just the only way we ever heard it. Now, if we learned English now, then that would be a nuisance. And especially if we got tired, we might say thinked. But with infants, it's astonishing how something that cannot talk yet and cannot do much of anything interesting yet, nevertheless, can learn to speak perfect Russian while we struggle along.
I know. Isn't it? Darn it. Darn it.
Yep, you're almost mad at them.
I know you are. What you talk about Spanish. I learned a little Spanish in high school. I haven't spoken it in years and years. But the way we phrase things, and it gives us an idea of how our rules and their rules are different. And so when we try to say something, we come out with our own American version or English version of what right. Spanish would be, and then how take this to other countries, to in other languages. And the phrase that you use is, I like the apples.
The apples, that's yeah. right. Yeah. Yeah, you learn in Spanish, and you get this in the first year. There's this little kink that you have to make your way over. You're learning how to say something like, I like apples. And you learn that there's this verb, gustar, and you think, well, that's like. And so you want to say, yo gusto las manzanas.
Sure.
I like the apples. And that's the way we kind of think it should be. But really, it's not that. It's the apples please to me. They phrase it differently. And so it's me gustan, please to me, las manzanas, the apples. And you learn that as something going on with one particular verb that we think of as annoying. But if you were in a situation where nobody was teaching it to you, there's no such thing as a book, nobody really cares how you talk, and you just have to basically get across fundamental information, and you're surrounded by people who are doing that with Spanish too, then you can tell that really what you would say is yo gusto las manzanas, and all of you would understand each other, and real Spanish speakers would know what you meant, and pretty soon that would just be the tradition. Imagine if the people who were coming in and speaking Spanish like that became the majority, or if children in that country started hearing you as much as their parents.
Right.
Next thing you know, you've got an unraveled Spanish, and that's what happened to a lot of languages around the world, like what we're speaking now.
Interesting. What you point to the difference in how long it's been we've been speaking languages, which is forever, and when we started writing languages, which is only about the last 5,000 years. How did mm-hmm. language change, if at all, when we started to write?
Well, when we start to write, for one thing, you can write language in a form that's almost impossible to do online when you speak. You can have longer sentences nested one within the other. When you have writing, you can preserve a richness of vocabulary which in just brains would be forgotten. And so, for example, you can look in the dictionary and find that there's a word Ruth. We all know what ruthless means, and we figure, but there's no word Ruth. Well, technically there is. Ruth means mercy, but it's not a word. It's just something that is preserved in dictionaries. That happens. But what also happens is that as people using language, if our language is one of the ones that's written, and very few are, only about 200 out of the world's 6,000 languages are written.
Really?
In a way.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's a very rare thing. But if we're speaking one of the ones that's written, then, for example, I'll say already. And naturally, you think of the word already written. That's not true if you're speaking, say, the 5,800 other languages, where if I say the word for already, there's nothing to picture because there is no writing. So we have a sense that real language is writing and then speaking is a version of it, when really speaking is what language is. Writing is a handy technological accident that came along late in the day.
Mm. And why is it that there are so few languages that have a written form?
Well, you know, if there are 6,000 languages and there are only 200 and change countries, then countries have to choose either one language or a bunch, but not all of them, to be the official one, the one that's going to make it in. And so, for example, depending on how you count it, Nigeria alone has 300 different languages spoken in it. Ooh. Everybody is going to have to communicate in one or just a few written languages. And so you can write English, you can write Hausa and Yoruba and Igbo. Those are the big three there. But then there are all the others. Those are just spoken, and their speakers find it peculiar to see a missionary or a linguist writing these languages down. And for them, what's written is English or one of the three biggies. The other ones are just spoken. And I think all of us, them and all of us, think that the ones that are just spoken must be, you know, they're just dialects, they're somehow lesser. But actually, those are the ones that tend to be more complicated than the big dude languages that become languages of empire and get written down.
Mm-hmm. And why is that? Why are they more complicated?
They're more complicated because they're the ones that never got learned by adults. So if you're talking about a little village language that's just been passed down normally, there hasn't been any grand invasion, it hasn't been spoken by people who spread throughout the world and had their language taken up by a bunch of adults, then that one stays normal. Whereas a language like English, with, for example, the invasion by Vikings, or a language like Persian, where it brought in workers from several different places who learned, you know, basically broken Persian, then you have a new new kind of language.
Hmm. 6,000 languages you say we have, but we're losing them. Are we losing them rapidly?
Yeah, that's happening pretty fast. By one account, a language dies every 2 weeks. And so, yeah, it's rather alarming. We have 6,000 now. It's said that in 100 years, we will have about 600 languages that are actually spoken. And so much of what linguists do is to basically document what the systems are of languages that are obscure and are not likely to live for much longer, because languages are beautiful things and they're also vehicles of cultures. But the world as we know it now is one where it's difficult to conceive of 6,000 languages living on as being passed down the generations.
Hmm. As I was reading your book, I was thinking, what a complex world you inhabit, don't you? When you think about all the languages there are and all the complexities of each language and the history behind all of those, it must be endlessly fascinating, and something must be always new.
That is true, actually. I mean, especially if you live in New York, for example, where there's so many people speaking so many languages, I think the normal conception, quite understandably, is that most languages are these dialects, or is it just some odd thing that isn't as legitimate as Japanese or English? But really, when you realize that each one of them is a treasure, kind of like a different kind of beetle or different kind of, you know, interesting African mammal, then you kind of want to know about it. If you ride in cabs, you ask the driver, so what do you speak? And often he'll speak something interesting that you've never heard anybody speak before. Each one has a different history. Each one has a fearsome grammar. And there's 6,000 of them worldwide. It's this wonderful terrarium, as opposed to what I think it's easy to think, which is that there may be several dozen languages that get written down, and then a whole bunch, and nobody knows the number, but a whole bunch of what you might call dialects that must be less sophisticated than Dutch and Japanese and not as interesting. If anything, it's the other way around. The language nobody's ever heard of is going to be this Baroque cathedral of a language that makes English look like Pig Latin.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. John McWhorter is our guest. His book, his latest book, is What Language Is and What It Isn't and What It Could Be. He is the author of a number of books, including the New York Times bestseller Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, and Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue. He teaches linguistics and Western civilization at Columbia University and will be with you momentarily. The number again, 800-486-8655. The email, you can use that, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with John in Phelps. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine.
John, I think I heard you on NPR, and you were quite interesting not too long ago. In any event, I've got a few quick questions. I've been studying Spanish for 40 years, and I've discovered hundreds of shortcuts, but they never seem to get taught by the teachers. And I wonder, in your looking into the future, when all of the Americas will be speaking both Spanish and English. Another quick question is, at what age does a child realize that they're speaking two languages when they've learned them from infancy? And the last question is, do you know the country that has the smallest language?
What's small?
What well, do you mean by fewer small? Words.
Okay, I'll do all three to the best of my ability. Languages are often not taught the way I wish they were, and sometimes I think of having a new career as I get older, looking into that, because I highly suspect that people could learn even complex languages faster and better than they do. Part of it is having a sense of what all the languages of the world are like in a general way, rather than thinking of the kind of Latinate conjugation/gender model as the way all languages are. And so, yeah, personally, you can come up with various shortcuts and systems that often will work better than what you were ever taught in school. So I definitely hear you there. On children, it can be surprising how early they understand that one language, for example, is something that only daddy speaks and the other one is what only mommy speaks, which I suppose means that they understand that there are different languages to the extent that they understand that that corresponds to countries and regions of the world. Of course, that only comes as toddlers become actual children rather than tiny post-larval beings. But they definitely do not simply think of words as words and muchacho and boy as direct synonyms. They have a sense that the foods are to be kept separate on the plate. And as far as the language with the fewest words, I'm pretty sure that that has never been tabulated. There is, to my knowledge, no naturally spoken language that has an unusually small vocabulary. There are languages that have unusually few sounds. And so, for example, there's a language in Papua New Guinea that only has 11 sounds, the five basic vowels and a scattering of consonants. And there are languages that are small in that way. But in terms of a language making do with 100 words, doesn't exist.
You tell the story of going to Indonesia, spending just a week there, calling Indonesian this strangely user-friendly language. So you were able to talk to people in about a week.
Funny thing with Indonesian, yeah. Indonesian is one of those languages where, for one thing, it's been used as a language picked up by adults more than children, probably, for a very long time. Then, if you go to each Indonesian-speaking location, it's being picked up even more by adults. Mm. And so many of the varieties of Indonesian are extremely user-friendly, and the word order is even flexible. So, in the book, I certainly don't imply that I was there speaking fluent Indonesian after 4 days. But if you learn a bunch of words, and it was a situation where English, French, and Spanish, which we Americans often think we can get by on in any country, just were of no use. So to have even a basic exchange, I'd like some water, you had to know some Indonesian once you stepped out of the hotel. Mm. You could do that and learn a tiny bit of grammar and actually be getting along, which was a joy because in just about any other country that would have been impossible.
Right. Yeah, I imagine it was a joy. Thanks, John. Alex in McFarland. Hi.
Hi. I have a niece who's 2 years old, and I've been wondering since she was born how I can get her to learn as many, you know, if nothing else, sounds. You know, like, I don't know. So what would be a good language or two for her to study just so she would have a broad base of sounds so, you know, she can make those sounds later on? It wouldn't be so hard.
Give her Chinese early. Because okay. The Mandarin Chinese system, which will be the most accessible,
right.
Very different from us. And she'll have the tones, plus the vowels and the consonants have a different flavor. So, yeah, that would be something to put in her brain early. And it would make it easier for her to pick up the less different sounds of many other languages.
And Mandarin's is kind of the best, most useful one? Or, I mean, are there others that are kind of...
Well, if you were going to throw at her languages that would be harder to find materials for, then, for example, Cantonese has 9 tones, but
sure,
you're going
right.
to have to look hard. Mandarin, you know, there are all sorts of baby Mandarin sets. You can get her Mandarin lessons where you live. So Mandarin Chinese would be the easiest thing, depending on where you are. Or if you're in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area, I'm mm-hmm. not sure what sort of facilities there are for learning Hmong, but Hmong would be the
sure.
exact same thing. And
okay.
so, and you would also then hear it spoken. And many varieties of Hmong have 9 tones, completely different sounds. And then she could actually practice with some people.
Perfect.
So that too.
We have some fairly large Hmong populations in Wisconsin, actually. So
then
that might be
Hmong.
A way to go.
That's
Hmong.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Here's an email from Dawn in Wausau. I'm a native English speaker, learned German in high school, got a degree in it in college. She went on to learn Italian under 30 years at an immersion language school in Italy for foreigners. She was surprised at how mixed up the languages were when she was trying to speak. She never accidentally used an English word, but there were times she would use a German word in an Italian sentence and not even realize what she'd done until the person gave her an odd look. I was genuinely moving up my second and third language and mixing them up and never my native tongue. Can you explain any of my experience of learning a third language as an adult?
Yeah, when you learn a second language after this critical phase, as it's called, of learning language. So when you're learning it non-natively, there is evidence that that new language is in a different part of the brain, which you can certainly imagine intuitively. So it's different neurons that are creating those signals and those memories. And as a result, all new language data is going to go in there rather than where your English was. And so naturally, especially maybe if you were tired or caught up or distracted, then you're going to have word slippages of that kind.
And we go next to Steve in Madison. Hi, Steve. Are you there, Steve? Steve is gone. Devin
the
from
absence of language.
Right. What are we going to do? It's radio. Hi, Devin from Princeton. Hi, Devin.
Hi. Good morning. Great show. Thank goodness your screener is on top of things this morning. I had told her I wanted your guest to comment about Esperanza, and she said, no, it is Esperanto.
Right.
Yeah.
It's because of that
so
jazz bassist, right?
Everybody on your show is always on top of things. But, yeah, I had read some things, I don't know, down the road about the Esperanto language and just wanted you to talk about it. I thought it was interesting. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. I get in trouble every time I write or talk about Esperanto. I somehow am never representing it the way the people who speak it and cherish it want to. So I guess I'm just going to mess up here. But Esperanto was created in the late 1800s by a man who sought world peace and thought that a world language would help with that. His name was Ludwig Zamenhof. And Esperanto is basically what would happen if you took the Romance languages and took away the complicated parts and made it all very regular and added some vocabulary from German and a sprinkling from some other languages, especially Slavic. But basically, it's what if you learn Spanish or Italian, you sort of wish it would be, all the hard parts taken away. So if you are a European language speaker or a Western European language speaker in particular, Esperanto is very easy to learn. This is an exaggeration, but the way it's advertised is that it only has 16 rules. And I used to speak it fairly well. Now, for me, it's a fond memory. But if you read a Romance language, you can read Esperanto pretty easily. And there are, I think at last count, 1 million speakers. There are Esperantist conferences and magazines and now websites. There are some children who are being raised in it and then an older language. It's a very interesting thing. I fear that the world's universal language, for better or for worse, is English. But Esperanto is the created universal language that has had the most success.
Here's something, not that everything is new that we're learning this hour, but if you learn anything new today, maybe this is it. Navajo, you write in your book, is the linguistic equivalent of the Notre Dame Cathedral.
I did write that.
Yeah, I know you did.
Navajo is just this joyous thing because not only is it a code, which is what gets around about it, Navajo is complicated. I mean, if you actually wanted to just not use it in an airplane in World War II, but to sit down and learn to speak the language, then that is one of these normal languages that I've been talking about. Navajo doesn't have any regular verbs. It's as simple as that. You think that most of the verbs will follow a pattern, and then you've got these nuisances, these irregular ones. And that's very European, and that's the way verbs work in a great many languages. In Navajo, you learn one verb, and you think, okay, there's the pattern. Then you learn the second one, and it's completely different. And you figure, well, there must be two patterns. And pretty soon, you're at verb number 55, and you realize there is no pattern. All of them just do their own thing. And yet, once again, children learn Navajo and think nothing of it. And it's something that gives you a humbling feeling, in a way, to see that this language spoken by just about 150,000 people, 170,000, is so complicated that it's awesome. And yet its speakers just think of it the way we think of English. And it's a great many of the languages in the world that are like that rather than this language we're speaking.
And it made it virtually impossible because of its complexity to break the code?
That definitely helped that nobody – it was when that happened, the Navajo were only aware of maybe a couple of dozen people who had learned the language as an adult. And even then, not well. You simply – and you don't want to – never say never. There are always people who are very dedicated. There are people who are language sponges. But really, essentially, you can't learn to speak Navajo well after a certain age unless you're really, really concentrating on it because it's just so ingrown.
Are you a language sponge?
Yeah. And I wish that I had more of an opportunity to exercise it, but my life is mostly in the United States, and I am long past my critical acquisition phase. But, yeah, I regret at this point that, you know, I kind of juggle about four careers. If I were – when I was 16, if I had gone to another country, I would have gotten much better at some second language than I've ever gotten. Now I fake it well. But, yeah, if I had to learn Navajo, I would have gotten obsessed with it. But that's weird. You know, most people are weird in other ways.
Yeah, we're all weird. Richard in Manitowoc. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. Say, I was interested in something that seems to be going on news programs, and that is what I would call a redundant subject. You can't listen to the news for more than half an hour before you hear it. For example, Barack Obama, he will speak in Wisconsin today. Instead of Barack Obama will speak in Wisconsin today. Or the Palestinians, they would like their own state. So it seems to go in the direction of complicating the language, and I wondered if your guest might comment on this and why it might be so.
Well, what you're talking about is something that is universal in the way languages are spoken as opposed to written. So if we're writing, we tend to be cleaner and more economical because we're thinking about it. Barack Obama will appear in St. Paul today. But in terms of speech, very often we'll say Barack Obama, he'll be appearing in St. Paul today. And in that case, grammarians say that Barack Obama is not the subject, it's the topic. This is a little little inside baseball, but for a linguist, the subject is the he, and then Barack Obama, which is outside of there, that's the topic. All languages have topic usage in that way. It's just a matter of whether or not in writing there's a convention of transforming that into a sentence where Barack Obama would be the subject. But what this means is that you don't only hear it on the news, you hear it used in ordinary speech all the time. Nowadays, there is an increasing informality even in public language so that no one would have said Franklin D. Roosevelt, he's appearing in Abilene today. But today, you'll hear newscasters saying all sorts of casual things, and one of them will be using this kind of topic subject rather than making everything into just ordinary subject grammar school sentences.
Amy in Milwaukee. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I have some of the guests kind of asked my question in a way, but as he was talking about languages not having written forms often, and then how many people across the globe cannot read or write, so then, you know, as we go in and we teach English, there's kind of the sense that we are trying to say this is the best language, or these people are losing their language because they're learning to read and write in English. And then along with that, as you're talking about the formality of English, there's, you know, the things in education. How much do we demand that children learn academic English versus maybe what is spoken in the home? And so I'm just curious about how we decide which language is the best language, or, you know, that sense that you're not saying this right, or that's not the right way to write it, or, you know, how do we help people keep their languages and yet teach a language?
Well, I'm going to quickly put on a hat, which is not mine, but I think I should represent this view. Many linguists or people related to linguists, like anthropologists or education people, might tell you that when you teach somebody who speaks a small unwritten language, one of the big languages, like if there's an Amazonian tribes person who's being instructed in Portuguese, then you're automatically interfering with their estimation of and their ability in their native spoken language because there's this sense of legitimacy that writing lends. And so they object in a way to the relationship between the written language and the spoken. I'm not sure what to do with that, but that is something that many people who could be on this show, you know, in 6 months would tell you. So that's that hat. But then the other one is that in terms of formality, I think of it as like pleated pants. And I don't remember whether I used this analogy in the book or not. But you have to teach people that there are forms which, for better or for worse, you can't use in public because they are looked down upon. Now, I, like all linguists, question the idea that there's an issue of logicality or clarity. If you say Billy and me went to the store, it's not unclear. And in terms of the logic, we could do a whole show on why what we're told about it is not true about subject and object, etc. But still, you can't say Billy and me went to the store while you're on a radio show, for example, unless you're talking about it rather than saying it. And so people need to know, but it's funny how arbitrary these things are. I learned about 10 years ago that pants that have the little pleats under the waistline, which I found very attractive, that's associated for some reason with being aged. And so I was told by various more fashion-conscious friends of mine that once I lived in New York, I moved here in 02, you can't wear the little pleats because it makes you look like a father, like you play golf. So now I don't wear the pleats, and I even see the pleats now myself as somehow kind of elderly, but that's completely arbitrary. They're quite aesthetically attractive. There's nothing elderly about pleats, but one must know. In the same way, you have to teach children there are things they have to know, grammatical pleats that they have to think about.
But people aren't saying, young people in particular, and I correct everybody I hear say this, Billy and me, they don't say Billy and me are going to the store. They're saying instead me and Billy are going to the store. What's that all about?
Well, see, me and Billy are going to the store strikes many people as okay, which is interesting because there, me is still this quote-unquote object form, yet people think that's okay. And this is the kicker on Billy and me went to the store. Notice that you can't say I and Billy went to the store. That sounds like a Martian or like a foreigner. So there's this idea of the order. But why is I and Billy wrong if I is the subject? Our whole sense of pronouns and subjecthood and objecthood is something that was imposed by a couple of people thinking about Latin 200 years ago. And I don't think I discussed that in the book. I discussed that in a different book. But it's this hoax. But still, pleated pants. You can't change the way people think. So you have to be careful when you use sentences like that.
Yes. Thanks, Amy, for the call. Peter in Bayview. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Regarding consonants and vowels, whether oral or written language, are vowels and consonants used throughout the world? And more specifically regarding vowels, what is the value of the vowel anyway? And here, I'm now past 74 years of age. I think it's about time I find out about that.
What an interesting question. Yes, it is a language universal, and there are not many of them, but it is a language universal that there are consonants and vowels. There are languages with hundreds of consonants and just a few vowels, and so the click languages of Africa are interesting because they're in some of them, they're over 100 clicks, and then regular consonants too. And then there are languages where really they're only, depending on how you count it, a couple of vowels. That's common, for example, if you are somebody who has had the benefit of a life as long as you just described, you might remember the Danone yogurt commercials from the 70s with the tall people in the Caucasus Mountains who supposedly get so old because they eat Danone yogurt. Their languages, many of them, only have two vowels. But as for the value of the vowel, the fact is that you need some sort of sound where your vocal apparatus can produce a whole buzzing, open sound. That's a useful thing to have in terms of just sound carrying as opposed to having only consonants. Some of the consonants have more buzz in them than others. But, for example, if you'd like to be able to talk in the dark or to shout, then it's helpful to have some vowels. And so there's no language that doesn't have any vowels.
Let's spend a few moments talking about English, one of about a dozen Germanic languages. Are you happy it's the one that you speak as your primary tongue?
Thank God. Yes, because
you are.
This language is the universal one, and so you're always blessed. Because imagine, you know, I talk about how English is streamlined, but imagine having to learn it. You know, all languages are hard. And so I am very happy to have this one because it does allow you to, and this is unfortunate because it's really a symptom of this general language extinction I'm talking about. With English, you can go almost anywhere. My Indonesian experience was bracing because it was the first time that I really would walk in somewhere and, you know, it was hot as anything and I wanted some water, didn't know the word yet. This was what convinced me to actually learn some Indonesian. Didn't know the word, and these people, they didn't know the word water. And how do you pantomime water.
Oh.
And so we all were just laughing. It was very funny. But I thought, I'm going to learn this word. And oddly enough, the word for water there is A-I-R. It looks like air. It's ire. And once you know, you can get yourself some darn water. But yeah, English is a very handy language to learn. Mandarin Chinese pretty soon will be ever handier. But English got there first. And so, yeah, I mean, I think of English as kind of mundane. Part of being a linguist is to find other languages interesting. But it is definitely a useful language to know.
We continue our phone calls in a moment. John McWhorter is our guest. His new book is What Language Is and What It Isn't and What It Could Be. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. One line is open if you want to get it. Call right now or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next call is Anita from Sullivan. Hi, Anita.
Hello, Anita from Delavan.
Oh, from Delavan. Hi, Anita from Delavan.
Hi. I have cousins in the Netherlands, and one of the older cousins expressed to me on a trip a couple years ago that she felt that the native language Frisian from the province of Friesland was dying. She said that the younger generation aren't using it. They're using Dutch instead. For example, one of her daughters married a man from a southern province of the Netherlands, and he didn't know Frisian. So now when the family gets together, they only speak Dutch.
Yeah, Frisian is one of that tassel of Germanic languages. As it happens, it's the closest language to English that exists, which in the case of English, because English is so peculiar, is not very. But you can – this is my poorly pronounced Frisian. Goed butter and goed cheese is goed Engels and goed Frisk. That means good butter and good cheese is good English and good Frisian. So that's how close you can make them artificially. But yeah, it's small, and almost anybody who speaks Frisian now also speaks Dutch. And so that's the kind of language that's threatened. Now, Frisian is written to an extent, and Frisian is used on signs, and there's an effort to keep Frisian going. But that is the sort of thing that happens, especially with marriages. If a Dutch person marries a Frisian-speaking person, speak Frisian natively, are the children going to speak Frisian? And if they half speak it, then are their children going to speak Frisian? And the answer is no. And so one does have to be careful with languages like that.
You are a language sponge. I'm quite impressed.
I'm clinically insane.
Thanks, Anita, very much for the call. Let's go to Janine in Green Bay. Hi, Janine.
Hi, good morning. Where do those endless number of words come from? 6,000 languages, there's no answer for the endless number. Where do they come from?
Why are there so many? Well, because if you take one, there's a first language at some point. Nobody knows when. Now, there are a lot of people somewhere. A bunch of them go move somewhere else because it's getting crowded. After people have been away for a while, sounds are going to change differently in one place than another. Grammar is going to change differently in one place than another, and you multiply that. I've never used this before, but just randomly, I'm going to take this. Here's the word what. Now, if you listen in particular to a lot of my sense of this is that it tends to be mostly white women and maybe Asian women who talk like white women, and they are about under 35 at this point. I'll say what? They'll say what? That kind of what?
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine that what becoming wit, it. Imagine it is the way somebody says what instead of what. That's how language goes. Well, imagine that happening to all the words in a language. Pretty soon you have a new one. And that happens, and next thing you know, you've got 6,000 different ones around the world. It's a magical thing, and we can't perceive it happening because it happens so slowly. But that's why there's so many.
Winning the prize for the listener farthest away, Nate writes to us in Malaysia. I'm an English teacher working in Kuala Lumpur. Don't you love this? You never know where the audience is.
No.
It's great. My students are mostly non-Malaysian foreigners eager to learn English, the global language. At what point in the future do you believe English will peak as the world's preferred language, and what possibly will overtake it?
Well, I think that English has already peaked in that way, and I think the internet really did put a point on it. Remember, just the pop music. Anywhere you go in this world, you are followed by even the worst of America's pop music. And because it's so infectious, because America's good at that, people want to know what it means. I was in Papua New Guinea once, and there was a boy of about 15 who could do pitch-perfect imitations of the singer Usher, singing in an English which he otherwise barely understood. And that's just the way it is around the world. The fashionable thing to say is that because China is going to be running the world at some point, and I do believe that, that Mandarin Chinese is going to take over. I doubt it. I've actually written an article or two about that, because Mandarin Chinese is harder to pick up than English, and because Chinese's writing system is murderous, as beautiful as it is, and English's spelling is not friendly, but it's a lot easier to write English than to learn the picture-based system of Chinese. So I think English has peaked. It will continue, and I say for better or for worse, because it's kind of a language monster, it will continue to be the most useful one. And that's because of history and just who gets there first. English right. happened to get there first.
George and Galena. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nigeria and learned to speak Hausa. And I was with our staff. We were all sitting having a beer speaking Hausa. And for the first time, I heard English, the foreign language. It sounded really odd. And I had to transfer to listening to English. I wonder if you've ever had that experience.
No, especially because I've never had to function in a language as completely unlike English as Hausa, even for a short time. But English is sonically a little odd. For example, if you've learned another language, chances are you had to not use a. We think of that word, that the sound that's in cat, as something very ordinary. Notice how unlikely it is that you've had to learn another language where there was an ah in it. Or also th. Th is not the rarest sound in the world, but it's a weird one, and that's why foreigners have trouble with it. It is a kind of an odd-sounding language. Many would say, and these things are highly arbitrary, but many would say quite ugly. I knew a German once who I said, I can imitate German. I can do the standard silly Hitler imitation, and I can do the Saturday Night Live Dieter kind of imitation of German. But what? How would you imitate English? How do we sound? And he said, oh, yeah, white sausage, banana, white sausage. That's how English sounded to him. So, yeah, it is an odd language, just like all languages are odd.
Email from Laura, a student at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. I'm doing some undergraduate research on the incorporation of podcasting in the foreign language classroom as an aid for foreign language learning. What do you think about podcasting for this purpose?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah, because like one of the worst aspects of learning languages until the invention of much of our modern audio technology, and this is me who started learning languages in the 70s and 80s, is that there's such a gulf between written, which is what you're basically taught, and then how people actually talk. And we often say, well, it went by so quickly. And it's not that people speak all that quickly. It's that we're not used to processing the language through our ear in real time. Now, instead of there being some tapes off in some room that you're assigned to spend 20 minutes with now and then, which really never did any good, you can actually have real people saying real things, and that can be put into everybody's iPods or whatever they have. And so you can find the spoken language not to be such an unpleasant surprise after you've spent as long as, say, 4 years or longer speaking a language and then get off the plane in the country and barely be able to understand anything anybody's saying. I think we're at the point now where we can get beyond that in a way that was not possible when, say, I was learning languages. Mm.
Thank you, George. Nice to hear from you. Felix in Managua. Hi. Felix?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please. Felix, I don't know where you are. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay, listen. People like Noam Chomsky years ago has said that rules of syntax are innate or hardwired in human beings and they're present at birth, as opposed to vocabulary, which is acquired. So syntax is a universal, and I guess that's my question. Is that comment on that, please?
Oh, yeah. That's still the going thing. Chomsky is still very much with us, and he has inspired a whole school of linguists who believe that syntax is genetically specified. This is hotly controversial. And a Chomskyan linguist would say that it's not just that we're specified to acquire language in a general cognitive way, but that in our neurons, in our brains, are very specific aspects of things, such as a kind of command that tells you how to link an ending to a root, that all of the, not a specific one, but just that endings and roots are going to come together. His idea is that we actually have a very specific genetic specification for that. Many people, and I would be one of them, would say that it's hard to imagine how something that specific would evolve via natural selection, but many of the Chomskyans have answers to that question. Chomsky is one of the leaders of the way linguistics is conceived of at this point. And so, yes, Chomskyan syntax is still part of what most linguists are trained in fundamentally, even if they move away from it, which I should say most do. He is the grandfather of much of the way we currently look at language.
30 seconds left. Email from Dave in Madison, who loves you, thinks this is a great show. Is it possible to learn or acquire an accent?
Sure. It depends on how good a mimic you are, or if you are in a situation where you have constant exposure to somebody who has that accent. Yeah, but it takes work. It is very difficult to do an accent. I was in a play very quickly once where I had to master a British accent. I don't know if I ever really mastered it. It was difficult for me as a linguist and as somebody who likes to imitate things, because phonology, the sound system of language, is something that is the most deeply ingrained. So it's tough to lose it. It's tough to imitate other people's.
Well, you were fun and you're so smart. This was great. Thank you very much. I just thoroughly enjoyed the hour. Please join us again. There's so much
we
never got to. Okay. Thank you, John.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Kathy.
John McWhorter. The book is What Language Is and What It Isn't and What It Could Be. He's great, isn't he? He teaches linguistics and Western civilization at Columbia University and has written many other books. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls. That was a lively hour. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. Great conversations ahead.